Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everyone, this is Justine Rutolo, also known as Miss ADD. The reason that I was waiting for a minute is my son had composed a theme song for me, more along the lines of the disco time, because that was my favorite time. And I was supposed to be hearing it, but I wasn't hearing anything. So I don't know if all of you heard it out there, but I didn't. So that's why I waited a few minutes. I want to welcome everybody to the program today. Sorry I missed last week, but as I said the week before, I got married, which was really exciting. We had a wonderful time. It was a small celebration, only family, a couple of friends. So it really worked out really well. And today what we're going to be doing is we're going to continue our discussion on emotional individuation. Give you a little history. I started doing this probably about 4 to 6 months ago, not only with my private clients, but also with my support group that I run on Wednesday nights at the Center for Learning Unlimited in Torrance, through CHAD. I'm on the board at CHAD, Children and Adults with ADD. And what I noticed as I went through my own growth period, my own journey or process, is that I was not emotionally individuated. I had not grown up. And so I had to do a lot of work to get to that place of being grown up. And even though it took quite a long time to get through it, when I got through it and out the other side, what I recognized was being grown up completely, not only physically, but emotionally. I was able to really be in control of the negative symptoms of ADD. So I wasn't procrastinating anymore. I was able to focus while being off my medication, because I had to come off my stimulant medication because it was making me too nervous, because in this whole process, I was really getting centered and focused. I also was able to emotionally regulate. So all of that was very exciting for me, and I really wanted to share this with others because I see ADD, as I have said before, as a gift. We are a member of the elite population. We're not linear and progressive. We jump around, but we are incredibly creative. That creative mindset is what makes Hollywood what it is today. So my book, which is at the publisher and due out hopefully within the next 3 to 4 weeks, actually has the cover designed by my son, who also composed my music that I didn't get to hear today, as ADD Land, saying that Hollywood should really say ADD Land, because that's what you have there. You have so many creative, wonderful people. So we're going to continue our discussion. A couple of months ago, we had David on the show, and I brought David back on today. So, David, if you want to pick up and say hi to everybody.
Hi, Justine. Can you hear me?
Yes. Okay, and I'm sure everybody else can hear you. So David has been in my group. He's also a private client of mine, and he has been going through this process, as everybody else has, of emotional individuation. And the last time we talked, David thought he believed that he went from a toddler to kindergarten. Was that right, emotionally? Is that how you described it the last time?
I think I was up to
second grade?
Almost third grade.
Okay, second or third grade. Okay, so I just wanted to spend some time talking to David today so all of you can hear the process that we've been working on and where he sees himself today versus 60 days ago, which was 2 months ago. So tell me, David, where are you today? If you're not in second grade, what grade are you in?
Well, I like to think I'm at least in fourth grade. And that
okay.
was actually, looking back in life, was a good year. I think that was a year where I had a wonderful teacher. And in the same way that in our group and coaching you're giving me, Justine, I feel like I have a good teacher in you. And I really think that's part of the process for us to move forward, is we do need good teachers. And
I agree.
What age you're at. And I'm realizing that I can also teach myself, and is to do so with compassion, patience, and kindness. And I also find that I'm being that way with other people on a more conscious, deliberate basis.
And so that, to me, really speaks to growth in terms of the emotional individuation, because that is one of the things that I noticed pretty quickly on into my own process, is that I was calmer and more loving with people that in the past might have really set me off.
Oh, yeah. I think for myself, definitely. I wasn't the type that would really snap at people. I could be extremely critical, but my mechanism to deal with the stresses was just to retreat, disengage, isolate myself. I have a brother who has ADD, and he was the type of person that was very defensive, and I think the way he protected himself was going on the counterattack, and he did not like to be criticized. I know none of us do, but when we're emotionally regulated, we're not as emotionally distressed when people criticize us. We can kind of take it in stride.
I think the emotional regulation piece actually comes with the emotional individuation. So Bowen, who is a psychologist from many, many years ago, I studied about him in graduate school, was really one of the first to quote the expression emotional individuation. And what Bowen says, because I've actually done a little bit of research recently on him, because I'm studying for my MFT exam, so I have to do some research. He actually says that you know you're emotionally individuated when you can be in the middle of the group of people in your life that have caused you the most difficulties, and you're okay with that. You're comfortable in your own skin. And that's exactly what happened to me in this whole process. So emotional regulation goes hand in hand with being emotionally individuated. Okay, I hope I'm not confusing people, but what happens in the individuation process is not only do we grow up emotionally, we are regulated, we're focused, we feel good, we can handle things. We develop what is called internal validation. And you've heard me talk about this, David, not only privately but in the group a lot. Because one of the things that I notice in our population, given our history of criticism from people that loved us but may possibly just didn't know better how to handle us, gave us a lot of criticism, whether that was at home or people that really didn't know us at school but saw behaviors that they didn't understand. Like for me, I was called lazy, stupid, procrastinator. And with all that, we weren't feeling good about ourselves. So we didn't have that ability to really give ourselves validation. We were looking outside of ourselves for that validation. And like little children, when we didn't get that validation or it was missing, it just didn't show up, we got angry. We got very upset. Whereas when you're emotionally individuated and you're an adult and people say negative things, you can handle that. I know I can now better than ever before because I am emotionally individuated. So I can handle the negatives because I have that internal validation. I feel good about me, and it doesn't matter what you think.
I totally agree. I think one of the things that I didn't realize about myself was why I so easily got angry as a youth and even as an adult. I learned to, I think, just be mature and know that in society, angry people don't get what they want, and they create more problems, and I was always trying to avoid problems, and so I learned to control my anger, but nonetheless still had those feelings inside. And I think a lot of them stem from the fact that I was looking outside myself for validation, for approval, for just acknowledgement, acceptance. And when I felt that I wasn't receiving that, you can't really act out as an adult as you would as a child, but still have these feelings of anger inside. But now I'm beginning to understand where this anger is coming from, and I'm able to just to let it go.
Where is it coming from?
I think the fact that I, as a child, was not able to really express my wants and needs, and so I was always hoping somebody would volunteer. I was always kind of waiting. I wasn't an outwardly needy child, inwardly most certainly, but outwardly where I was demanding. I didn't demand, and I was just always kind of waiting and never really being acknowledged, just being ignored. And I guess, you know, I behave fairly well behaved, so I didn't really cause problems. And I think you probably want to get into what our role was in our family growing up. I was the child with ADD that was not really acknowledged. I was not considered the IP.
Identified patient.
That's
the IP, yeah.
I had a younger brother who was, we used to call those the black sheep in the family. They were the ones who always got into trouble, and he certainly was a handful for my parents. And in comparison, I was, you know, a model child, even though I really wasn't.
So can we wait for that for
sure.
Just a moment? Because what I want to do is explain to everybody just the more about the steps, and that is more towards the end.
Okay.
Of what we've been doing recently. In the very beginning of this process, we talked a lot about self-awareness, because I think, as you agree now, unless you're self-aware about behaviors, about how your behaviors either affect you or other people, how you present to other people, if you don't see these things about yourself, then there is absolutely no chance for any kind of change whatsoever.
Oh, I totally agree.
Right. So just so you know, Wednesday night at the group, in case any of you listening live in the L.A. area and want to come and join us, there's a lot of growth going on in that group that's just pretty amazing. I really want to spend probably 2 or 3 weeks on self-awareness, because I get the feeling that it's just not happening. It's just not there. I know you are self-aware. I know you are. I know there is a number of others who are. But I've had private conversations with some of the people in the group. They are not self-aware. So I really want to get into staying there for 2 or 3 weeks so we can really figure out what's the block to some of these people of not seeing their behaviors and the way they react and things that happen for them, and hiding certain things from other people because they're afraid. They may see it, but they don't want anybody else to see it. So they put on that mask, and it's the back of the mask and all that. Is it related to fear? Is it related to anxiety? I don't know, but I want to explore that a little bit. So self-awareness was actually the first step in the whole process, and we spent very little time on that, which I think was another kind of mistake on my part. But again, for everybody who's listening, this is a process that I work through the process, but in sharing it with others, what I'm beginning to see is that the steps that I took may not necessarily work for everybody in the group. We may have to mix things up, which is what we've been doing a little bit.
Justine, I don't think that not addressing self-awareness first was a mistake. Per se, because of the work we were doing, like in the book, The Untethered Soul,
right,
that doesn't really address that, but it's really dealing with awareness from a different level, and that is consciousness.
Right.
And since many ADD people, myself included, have like, you know, 5 to 10 thoughts running through our head at the same time, we somehow think that
it's a good point.
Yeah, this myriad of thoughts is who we are, and we are so, I call it, muddled in our minds that we don't really have time to really be self-aware because we're ruminating on so many different points. But getting back to the idea of self-awareness, I think for myself coming into the group, that's I kind of achieved a little bit of that. I acknowledged that I wasn't self-aware. I was coming from a place of no self-awareness to just a beginning, an awakening towards that.
Yep.
So I was seeking to become more self-aware, and I can say for myself, it was probably stemming from following factors. One would be just the fear of really being in touch with yourself. You have a certain habit and pattern, a way of dealing with other people. You've been able to hide from yourself for so long, you just want to continue doing that. I wasn't able to really do that because my wife was fed up and she wanted me to deal with this. And
yeah.
So I had her help, encouragement, both positive and negative, because there was times she was just really frustrated. And it was really hard for her to be kind, loving, and understanding. But for the most part, she has been. And that's kind of a blessing.
She really has.
Yeah. I for somebody who doesn't have ADD, I think she is quite a remarkable woman in that one regard. So,
but you know what, David? I do want to say something. Because I think this is really important for people who are listening, especially couples that are listening. Okay, when I first met you and I met Connie, there was a resentment and an anger from Connie that I had not, I hadn't experienced before, okay? It was intense. She was very angry. She was very resentful for a lot of things. Here's the piece that's so powerful. You aren't yet to that place where you want to be, and let's say to the end of the individuation process, but you're working towards that. I remember at one point, Connie came in, and we talked, and she was really talking about a lot of her resentment and feelings and wanted to know from me, how long was this process going to take? And I told her I thought it was going to be about a year because that's how it worked for me. And she was okay with that. And I was surprised because the level of the resentment and the anger that I had seen prior to that, I didn't know how she was going to handle it. But she handled it beautifully, and she was accepting of it, and she's seeing the growth, the little baby steps that you're making. And things between the two of you, I see a big change in how she approaches you now. It's very different than before. So I give her a tremendous amount of credit, and you, for all the work you're doing. But a lot of times people want it today. He's got to change today. And that's not what I felt.
I agree with you. I feel that my wife has certainly become much more patient, much more understanding. I think it's hard for really anybody without ADD, living with an ADD person, to be patient.
Yeah.
Part of where I think her, why I think she's so remarkable is that she's really had to deal with some things in her own life and come to grips with the fact that we are all, no matter who we are, how we are, how our brain is structured, we all need to learn to be more patient. We need to learn to handle difficulties of life. I think it's also just part of any marriage. You have periods of married life that can be okay, and then other times which are not for a variety of reasons. It could be sickness, it could be financial problems. This is something quite different, but it's still a problem that can occur in marriage. And I think all married couples that have marriages that last and that can thrive, they learn to grow beyond their difficulties. And
right.
I think that's what she's doing.
Yep.
And that's part of her growth. And I'm beginning to see as I look at this ADD, I know we're trying to help people with ADD and ADHD, but I'm beginning to understand this whole emotional regulation, becoming emotionally healthy. It's really for the whole population.
It really is.
And there may be other people that can, get things done. They don't procrastinate. They don't have these other emotional problems. But they're still under a lot of stress.
Yes, and they're also very much as many people who are not yet grown up emotionally.
Well,
even though they don't have attention deficit disorder.
Well, our society's manufactured that.
Right.
70 years ago, a young teenage boy was given a lot of responsibilities, and prior to the 1930s, we didn't really have teenagers. You went from a youth, became a young man, and became a man.
Right.
And there wasn't this period of time of extended adolescence. And I think for the most part, it's continued.
It's now 11 to 25. That's the new age of
correct,
adolescence.
Correct, because it certainly, you know, all the way through college.
Right.
And now, when it's so hard for young people to get jobs, many of them are still living home. It's kind of hard to be out, to be mentally on your own when you're still living with your folks. And so wouldn't it be wonderful if we could turn this around for all, I can just speak for the men, somebody else will speak for the women, but for a young man to say, look, these are difficult financial times. Families need to band together and help one another. I may have to live with my folks till I'm 25 or older, but I can still start being responsible and start acting like
a
man and helping out.
Then here's what I have to say to the parents that are listening, because I think this is important. I've said it before. I've said it more than once. So Dr. Gabor Maté wrote an incredible book. The name of the book is called Scattered. And, you know, it takes you through infanthood all the way up through adulthood and into couples. And it's an amazing book because he talks about what's underneath that ADD. You know, what is it that can really exacerbate a lot of the symptoms. And one of the things he says, and this is why I wanted to bring this up for anybody who's listening, who's a parent of an adolescent, there is absolutely no chance of autonomy or individuation without motivation. It's the other way around. There's absolutely no chance of internal motivation. So when you want your child to get up, go do their homework, go take out the garbage because you ask them once and you end up asking them five times, or you want them to walk the dog or whatever, there's no chance of internal motivation unless there is autonomy or individuation. Sorry, I switched it around. And that's what you want to strive for with your children, is individuation. I talked about this last week. I'm just going to say it again. 3 weeks ago, my younger son, who composed the music for my show, is an extremely talented young man, is on the autistic spectrum at the low end. He's got nonverbal learning disability, but did a lot of work with him, so he's a really outstanding young man. But he came home, had dinner with my husband and I, and said, you know, Mom, one of the things that you did that I guess was a little upsetting when I was growing up is you did too much for me. You did my laundry. You did too much, and I never really learned how to do things before I left the house. So I listened to him very calmly because I'm emotionally, you know, individuated, so my regulation was good. And I said, but, you know, I do recall as you were getting older asking you to do some of these things, and you would look at me with a blank stare on your face as if you didn't know how to do them. And he started to laugh, and he said, Mom, that was nothing but manipulation, and you bought it. And so he said, you know, and I'm also telling you this because I think you can help some of your clients right now with this whole thing. And, you know, he's absolutely right, because over the past 3 weeks I have brought this up to clients and teenagers being in the room, and they were smirking. So believe me, I've learned now that you really have to help your children to grow up, and you can do that by allowing them to make mistakes and to do things for them on their own. I mean, I think that's how we become individuated, not only physically but also emotionally individuated. So I just wanted to throw that out. Let's get back to the steps. So self-awareness, we started with self-awareness. We're going to move on. From there, I asked you all to go and do a genogram.
Right.
It's been a while since you've talked about the genogram, and I think the last time we talked on the phone, you hadn't even done it yet.
I think you're right. I did it probably a week or two after.
Right. So can you talk a little bit to everybody about what that process was like for you, what it was? What's a genogram?
Yeah, a genogram is like just describing your family tree, describing your family, immediate family, siblings, parents, then your grandparents, any aunts, uncles, great aunts and uncles, as far back as you can, and look at all your different relatives, see the relationships between one another, the interactions, and then each person individually, what their life was like, what their strengths, their weaknesses, were similarities, the differences, because in families, in the same way that brothers and sisters can all be different, even though we have the same parents, families can also have some vast differences. And you can see with families who was successful, well-adjusted in life, and then who were the people that had difficulties. And we did this in the group, and so we were able to listen to other members, and it was really illuminating to see the variance in kind of human life experience. Some people came from very traumatic, very horrendous family situations. There was a lot of abuse and alcoholism, drug abuse, dysfunction, divorce, and others not so much, but still underlying there were still stresses. There was maybe cases of depression or other what people would call some sort of mental
illness.
Mental illness, for lack of a better term. And I think for my family, I certainly did not rank up there with the families that where people really suffered with alcoholic parents and, in many cases, many generations. There really was no drug abuse in my family until my generation. I had a brother who had problems with alcohol and every single drug. And I can say today that he has been sober from alcohol probably going on 9 years. He's been clean from drugs for more than a year. And just recently, he completely quit smoking cigarettes. So he is, for the most part of the past year, just is living his life no longer chemically altered. And it's just a whole new way of living for him. I see great improvements in him. But
okay, wait one minute, because I think it's great you're talking about your family. But
what do you want me to focus on?
All right, what I'd like you to focus on is, what did this genogram, this process of the genogram, how did this help you to understand the tethering process?
Okay. I can see that in my family there was that tethering. And it was kind of subtle because both my parents are still alive. They're still married. They've had their ups and downs, but I think they've been very successful in their lives. Because they've endured and they've persevered and they've overcome all the challenges that they've had. And so they can't say that life was easy. It wasn't for them in many ways. But so I see there was a lot of love, a lot of commitment to one another. But at the same time, there was just still this emotional craziness in the family. It came from a very boisterous, loud family.
Which you hadn't seen. Would you say that it really highlighted that when you did this process, that was highlighted more?
And okay. I've had other observations with other people who didn't grow up the way I did, and I thought my upbringing was normal. And now I see other people in the group, and they thought their upbringing was, quote-unquote, normal. And
right.
We all can look around now and say, no, it wasn't. This was crazy.
Right.
And getting to the point of tethering, I can certainly see that in my case, I have three brothers, and we have a very dominant mother. She's just kind of a force of nature. I mean, a remarkable woman in many ways, but I can say that she has her form of ADD and was able to cope and function best she could. But still, there was just a lot of craziness. So a very loving woman, but also very critical and very demanding and very kind of harsh. I look back now, and I think she was very much overwhelmed by having four sons, and her way of dealing with us was clamping down on us.
Right. So in the process of all this, one of the things that we did was everybody got up, not everybody, because there were some people that wanted to do their genogram with me personally because they didn't want to share it with everybody, which I totally respect, and I never force anybody in the group to speak unless they're comfortable speaking. But one of the things that we did was we then looked at chapter 6, Secrets of the Spiritual Heart in the Untethered Soul. And the reason I wanted everybody to go back, which we're going to do this again, is because that chapter talks about samskaras, and that's the word they use in Buddhism. And I hope I'm saying that correctly. I may not be. But really what it is, it's impressions from the past. Impressions. and the impressions from the past that we need to release. We need to run those negative impressions, because clinging are positive. Impressions are more of the negative things that happen. And so in this chapter, what they talk about, for those of you who don't know about The Untethered Soul, I would suggest you go and buy the book. It's a tremendous book. But this chapter in particular talks about how important it is to release those impressions, so that once we release them, we run them through our heart, we can be at peace with those things. And I think, did that help you in this process?
Yes. Part of the difficulty I'm having is to really get in touch with those scars and to recognize them for what they were. And then also to have the awareness of who I was as a child. I was kind of sick as a child. I was really kind of weak. And I had a lot of anxieties. That just might have been my nature. And so I was, I think, overly sensitive. I think that was, you know, other children, maybe a little bit more robust, would have endured what I put up with. And so you can almost say, gee, this kid was, you know, just a weakling who couldn't handle some basic difficulties. But that's just the way I was. You take like a child who has allergies, other sensitivities, and you wish your kid didn't have asthma, hay fever, or all these other problems, but that's what the child has, and you have to deal with it. And when I was growing up, there was really no recognition that some kids were more sensitive to others and that they needed to be treated differently. We all kind of got treated, not really roughly, I mean, compared to today, maybe so. It was just kind of the end of the period where children were seen and not heard. We were, you know, made to behave, and if not, you were smacked.
Right.
And that was accepted behavior. It's funny now, if you could take my parents' generation, if you could bring them to just to today, and they were raising kids today, they'd all be under arrest.
They would be.
Under the current set of laws that we're living under. So I don't think that would be the solution. But I just remarked that was a different time. So I think in some ways parents today are raising their kids, I think, with a little bit more understanding and a lot more gentleness, and I think that's a good thing.
Yes, although at times I think that the pendulum has swung too far to the other side and we're raising a lot of little narcissists because, you know, they're perfect. They can do anything they want to do, and that's just not true. And so I think that parents that are listening, that are raising kids, you know, I think getting parenting classes, working on how to parent in the middle, okay, because I think that's very important. Extremes, you know, being too rough or being, you know, my child is up on a pedestal, that's extremes, and that's not good. Then kids don't know how to handle situations that come up. Because if they're this Adonis, if somebody in school questions something they're doing, they're going to fall apart. And if they're being traumatized at home, then that's the way they see themselves as this bad kid. They can't function in society. And these are the kids that, both sets of kids, that end up getting into trouble. So I think we need to bring that pendulum in the middle. And, you know, yes, you and I grew up in the same time where, you know, we were hit and we weren't spoken to all the time in the nicest way. I do remember growing up, and when my father would say the word, you know, shut up, it would destroy me. It really hurt me. You know, I never had an opportunity to say that to him, but it did. And, I don't think he ever meant to hurt me on purpose, but it was what they knew back then. And children should be seen and not heard. That was a big thing that I heard.
Hear that as much, but there was certainly a time when you were supposed to be behaved and quiet.
Right.
You weren't to speak up.
So the interesting thing is that when we talk about these impressions that from the past, they live with us until we look at them. They live with us. Last week at the wedding, David happened to be at my wedding because he was kind enough to do the pictures. David is an extremely talented photographer, so I appreciate that you did that for us, David. My brother was there with his wife, my two sisters with their husbands. I love my family. I appreciate so much that they flew out here. And Steve and I were dancing to a song by Rascal Flatts, Northern Star, I think the name of it is. And it's a beautiful song because Steve and I have been through a lot of our own trauma in other relationships that we've had. We're not victims. We take full responsibility for those, our part in those relationships. But the song kind of talks about how all that stuff that you went through really led us down the road to each other. And it was a beautiful song, and I started to cry while we were dancing. And I'm sorry. The name of it is Broken Roads. Okay, Steve just handed me a piece of paper. Thank you, Steve. You know, ADD people like to name things anything they want. There is a line in there about Northern Star, though. That I do know. Anyway, I'm dancing. I'm crying. I look over at my brother, who's sitting at the edge of a seat, and he says to me, "I'll give you something to cry about." And he goes, "Remember that? Remember that?" And I just kind of looked at him, and he was talking about when we were growing up, that was something that my father would say to us. As I look back now, my father said that. It was many times when we were going to the doctor, and he didn't want us to cry because he didn't want to see us get hurt. And instead of being able to say, "I'm so sorry that this injection that you're getting ready to get is going to hurt you," that is what he would say so that we... So we would, but it's funny, but it's also sad that my brother, who's 4 years older than me, so he's 63, he remembers that like it was yesterday, and I hadn't thought about that in a long time. So you talk about impressions, and he is not emotionally individuated. That is kind of sad.
But doesn't that show you that how what parents say to their children sticks with them their whole life?
Yeah.
And so it's almost a reminder to all parents to be aware what you say to your children.
Yeah.
And not to, you know, worry about the thing, "Oh my goodness, I'm going to scar my child," or "I'm going to say the wrong thing." But I don't want to revisit it, but I think maybe another talk can be how the pendulum has swung.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really think of that I think I learned to deal with disappointment, and so because I had a lot of disappointment.
We all did, yeah.
And so I just kind of suffered under it, and so as an adult, I could handle disappointments. And I think in society, that bodes well. I think the narcissist who can't handle disappointment, that brings more immediate problems
mm-hmm.
when they're in the midst of a disappointment and they don't handle it correctly, because now other people that are interacting with them are just aghast at their immature behavior. So I think that's certainly, it does exist in the ADD population. It's probably young kids growing up today are going to function with that. The way I look at it is that each child is certainly unique, but we're not all exceptional.
No.
Exceptional comes from exceptional conduct, actions, behavior, what you accomplish, what you do. And so...
And I think that we have to also be able separate out who we are from what we do. And I do believe that many times what happens is, we send our kids off to school. I used to say to my boys every morning before they left school, "Guys, school is what you do. It is not who you are." Big difference because, you know, just because you get straight A's in school, you know, Ted Bundy, he had a really high IQ, and I think he got straight A's. So, you know, just because you get straight A's doesn't mean you're a good person. He was a serial killer, for God's sake. So, you know, let's not just tell our kids that if you want to be a great person, you have to get straight A's in school, because that's where it gets muddied up. What's in here is what's important.
Justine, I have a question. Since we're talking two ends of the spectrum and we're really trying to talk about the issue of self-awareness, certainly somebody who was told to be seen and not heard, that was not allowed to be expressed themselves, And then on the other hand, a child that was allowed to do pretty much whatever they want because the parents didn't correct the child in any way whatsoever. It seems to me that in both cases, those two environments the kids grow up in, does not allow for the kid to really become self-aware.
No, absolutely not, because in the environment where you're seen and not heard, you most of the time are at the knees of a narcissistic person. When you grow up in that kind of environment, there is no chance of development of sense of self. When you're raised by a narcissist, everything's about them, everything. And you are objects to them. You are not human beings, okay? The other extreme of you do everything perfect, and that is such a dichotomy. And you may be raised there, by a narcissistic person or a borderline, personality disorder, or somebody, who is depressed and wants to put you up on this pedestal. I tell people all the time, there's no such thing as pedestals in life. Nobody belongs up there. So there is no chance of development of self when you're up on a pedestal. Because life is full of ups and downs. In life, things ebb and flow. It's like the ocean, right? Relationships ebb and flow. Life ebbs and flows. We have good days and we have not so good days, right? We try to live our life in the moment, because that's what we do along with everything else we're learning in the group.
So I can kind of address what I'm trying to do as an adult to become self-aware, but I'm thinking from a parent's role, because in some ways I have to like self-parent myself. But what I'm thinking as I hear you describe these two different ends of the spectrum, and you mentioned earlier about being in the middle, it seemed to me to be in the middle, a parent or an adult trying to parent themselves, what they would need to do is to draw the child out, to get them to acknowledge their feelings. I think a good parent
acknowledge their feelings, but there's something else too. They have to have a connection, okay? So there has to be empowerment for a child, because that child needs to feel like, they're good, they're wonderful, but there also needs to be a connection to other people. And if we're not good at parenting, we're allowing our children to run the house, for example.
So would that be a combination of, first the parent would allow the child to express how they are feeling?
Right.
And then in conjunction with that, to get the child to take a look, recognize what the feelings of other people are.
That's the connection. And that's what we're missing a lot of today, because these children are so empowered that they don't care about other people. You see the narcissism? Because they don't care about other people. They don't want to know about other people's feelings, because how could they possibly understand that? They haven't been raised that way. When a child is 3 years old and a parent has to give that child a consequence and says to that child very kindly, mommy believes that you need a time out. I'm not angry. Mommy just thinks that you need a time out. What the child is beginning to see by the parent following through now, that's the most important thing, is that this mother has needs too. It's not only the child, the little id, that has the needs, it's the mother. The mother needs that time for the child to go and have some quiet time. Don't ever put your child in a room alone and shut the door. That's not a time out. That's a punishment. And that's not good for development, a psyche development. What you do is you have a special place where the child can sit. You don't want to have a bunch of toys around, but you just need a timeout so they can sit on the stairs.
Is that sort of like what used to be putting the kid in the corner?
Yes, which is really horrible.
Okay, I can see that, but the parent can certainly observe the child.
Yeah, but you don't turn the child around to face the wall.
Okay.
See, that's really destructive for the child.
Okay, I don't know. I'm just, self-esteem. Again, going back to my childhood, that was accepted behavior. And
right. I got put in the corner in school a lot, and that really hurt me
a
lot. So, I know we're digressing a little, but this is a good point, because I think it's important for parents that kids are coming up and, they're getting older, a child really needs to understand connection. For example, if a child hurts another child's feelings, they really need to understand that, would you really want to play with that child if he spoke to you that way? See, those are the kind of questions.
Okay, so you're all really trying to teach a small child the golden rule.
Yeah.
To do unto others as you have them do unto you.
And feelings, like you were saying.
Right,
how does that make you feel?
But I think that's where... But this is, I think, you know, child psychologists or people that study child development, they could probably describe this, I guess, from a clinical point of view more accurately. But what I'm...
That's what I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let me just ask you, is that as a child, there's certain ages where they only see themselves, but is there...
Right. And that's really from 0 to 14 months.
Okay. And then they start...
And then they start to really... Okay, so after the 14 months part, they start to walk away from mom or dad, and then they're looking back.
Right.
So they understand that now they're separate, okay? And that goes to 3 years old. And that after three comes that period where it's all about them, okay? And that's that, you know, 2 to 3 years old where they start throwing temper tantrums if they can't get what they want. And so many people will say, ignore those tantrums. That's not the way to do it. You don't have to hit them. You don't have to scream at them and yell. What you do have to make them understand is that if they're going to behave that way, then there's going to be a timeout. And what that behavior is telling you, that's how you say it to them, is that they need a timeout. Mommy's going to help you learn how to self-soothe. See, that's something, because in learning that, then what the child is, it's more of a connection because they're seeing, gee, mom has some needs here, and her needs are, I need to behave in a, you know.
The child is beginning to see that his behavior's affecting in a negative way, for lack of a better word, his parents or the people that love him and that he loves.
And here's the biggest thing of all. I was 54 years old before I learned how to self-soothe. 54. And there are so many people in our group who are older than that who still do not know how to self-soothe. That's the emotional regulation. If those of you listening have children out there and you really want to do them the biggest favor of their life, help them learn how to self-soothe at a young age.
So a timeout is, again, you know, you haven't really discussed this much in the group and in the way you're explaining it.
Well, because
today.
There's no kids there.
Oh,
we don't talk about parenting.
But I began to see how this is important for people of any age.
Oh yeah.
Because
timeouts are real important.
And I can understand why a lot of people turn to alcohol and other things, because that's like a, it's a timeout. In fact, I used to say this, that I can only speak for men, but it's just that every man needs his timeout.
Right.
And for a lot of years ago, when a guy's working a factory or a real manual job, and I just didn't want to go from the job and go home and then deal with the wife and the kids and everything.
So they go have a drink.
Go have a drink. And that really was for them to kind of decompress and make the transition. That was their timeout. And that's why so many men watch sports.
Yeah, it's a timeout.
It's a timeout.
Okay, so here's something you've heard me say in group that I want to share with the people who are listening today. So when I started this process for myself, what I recognized was that when my emotions would come up over me like a tidal wave, okay, like if somebody said something to me that was hurtful, I recognized self-awareness, that these emotions were coming over me like a tidal wave. And when you get caught in a wave, for anybody who's been in the ocean, it's very difficult to get out of there, you know, let alone a tidal wave. So what I decided is that when I felt these kind of things from something that was said to me, whether it was from my children or from my life partner at the time, who's now my husband, that I would sit with these feelings for a couple of days. And that was my time out with my emotions. And let's see what would happen. Well, the most amazing thing is that what seemed so monumental at the moment when it happened, 2 days later, the balloon popped and it lost so much power that I was able to talk about it in a much calmer way.
Okay, but I want to understand how you do this. So you actually just recognized that you're in the middle of a tidal wave. You have
right.
all these overwhelming emotions.
Right.
And then you made the decision to say, you know, I'm going to let them sit.
Exactly.
So you're not going to deal with them. It's like you almost like you lift yourself out of the water above the tidal wave.
Right.
Levitate.
Well, like here's what I'll give you a specific example. I came home one day. I was living with Steve, and something came up. Something happened as I walked through the door that upset me very much. I went into the kitchen, and I felt these feelings coming up. And I think you know, anybody who's listening know, when those emotions come up, that hurt, I was very hurt. I went to the kitchen, and he came in behind me, and he said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "You know what, I just really need to go out for a little while." Because I knew that if I talked about what just happened at that moment, because he was oblivious to what had happened, he didn't see it, that I would really hurt him and hurt me. And I didn't want to do that ever again. So I got in my car and I drove around this beautiful place that we live in, Palos Verdes, for about an hour. And I came back and he asked me, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm okay." And he said, "Do you want to talk?" And I said, "No, not now, but I'll talk to you about it." And I waited 2 days and I sat with what had happened for 2 days, and I thought about it, and I let it go. And I think about it again, and I let it go. And as the days went on, every time I would think about it, it wasn't as powerful. What I did was I took its power away.
Okay, how I relate to what you're saying, because I'm beginning to experience something similar to that. But what I'm recognizing is when things affect me in the present, things that really hit me the most, that really hurt me the most, are really rooted in my past.
Yes, yes.
And so now I'm beginning to recognize that something that happens, the reason I'm so upset isn't because of that particular incident, what
no.
the person said or didn't say or what was done or what wasn't done. It brings up emotional past.
And I want to tell you something. I know you're getting better. I'm so excited for you. Because when people get that piece, that's when they're really getting better.
And I agree. It's such an important piece because the power of it is I can now recognize where the feelings are coming from.
Right.
And since it's something that happened such a long time ago.
It's an impression.
It's an impression. And the thing that I've come to understand is that, and just ask, anybody can really ask themselves this question. Why would you allow something that happened 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago to still upset you?
You know why? Because you never dealt with the feelings of hurt. And
right.
that's the chapter 11 in the book, The Untethered Soul, Pain, my favorite chapter, The Price of Freedom.
If I can add this, because this is more of a mental construct that helps me to let go of things. And maybe as I grow, I'll be able to do this more fully. But what I had an experience where a number of weeks ago I had something, interaction with an individual that was quite upsetting. It was unusual. I don't really run into people that vicious. And
I know the story.
Yeah, and very irrational. Yeah. We don't need to go into the details. But just the point is, it really affected me. And I did everything on my part to rectify things and to be responsible for my end. And from that person's point of view, just nothing was going to soothe them. But the funny thing was, the following day, my wife and I, we went down to Newport Beach, where we had a wonderful day and a lovely lunch and just, you know, a great August summer day. And yet, as I'm having this wonderful day with my wife, we don't get a chance to get out that often, I was thinking back on this, and it was upsetting me. And I just had to stop myself, and I just laughed, and I said, "This is amazing. Here I am with my wife, who I love. We're having a great day. It's a beautiful day here. And I'm allowing something that happened to me yesterday to bother me today. And it was affecting the enjoyment of today." And all of a sudden, I said to myself, I said, "You know, stop it. Because I don't need to allow
right.
something that happened yesterday
right.
to affect me today, so I can't enjoy today. And if I can do that with something that happened yesterday, why should I allow something that happened in my childhood 40 years ago to affect me today?
I'll tell you why. Because a big part of it is the fact that when we're young and our psyches are very, very sensitive, and people with attention deficit have sensitive psyches to begin with, it when it hits us like that, that very hurtful stuff when we're very young, it can really take a long time for us to be able to release that. Once we release it, and I can see it for myself that there's so much that I have been able to release, and in releasing all that, when it comes back up for me now, it's a very, very different place than I was before. And that's why I'm just so big with the group on being able to deal with some scars, the impressions from the past, do the genogram, and let's look at all this pain. Let's look at who was it in the family that we were so tethered to? Why were we so tethered to these people? Was it dysfunction? Was it mental illness? Was it substance abuse? You know, we have one gentleman in the group who spoke about his father, and his father had a drinking problem, and that he remembers being a little boy and just really having to feel, you know, the yelling and the pain, and then as he got older, he was able to really speak to other people who knew his father when his father was, you know, before his father went in the war and suffered PTSD. And now he has a completely different feeling about his dad.
Well,
so
we understand now that, and we're seeing this unfortunately with the young generation coming back from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places, that men and women are coping with this by drinking. And so the gentleman I think you're referring to, his father fought in World War II almost for the whole duration, and he did survive it, but I think he was so traumatized by it that he spent the rest of his adult life drinking. And you're right, that is, I think, a powerful example of how we can be affected by the experiences in that our parents experienced and how they learned to cope. So hopefully with us gaining this understanding, I think that there can be a lot of healing, not just in the ADD population.
But all over.
All over. And I think that there's a great need for helping the young men and women coming back from the wars of the past 10 years to deal with
the PTSD.
And it's been multiplied because they have multiple deployments.
Right.
So it's going to be addressed.
So let's go on now. Okay, so we talked about the genogram, and there are many people in the group who shared their story, very, very powerful stories. I had one person in particular who's also a private client of mine say, wow, you know what? The minute I shared this, things started to get better for me. I started to feel better. I was releasing things. I saw it differently. So that was really, really big. Then the next question I asked in this whole process of emotional individuation was, what was your position in the family? So I gave them, what I did was I gave them a specific examples. Like, for example, in my family, there was four of us, a brother, two sisters, and myself, and my mom and dad. I was the youngest. I was considered the IP, the identified patient. And in family therapy, that is the person who is perceived as the one who needs all the help. They're the identified patient. Okay. But what's fascinating about family therapy, and eventually I want to get certified in that, I want to go to the Mnuchin School in New York and spend a couple of weeks and get a certification, because I love the whole concept and I'm strong, so I think doing family therapy would be wonderful for me to do and to help others. It's powerful because when the IP comes into the therapy setting and the other members of the family are there, what happens is the terrible stuff that was put onto the IP gets spread out among the family. This is communication issues. This is boundary issues. With the boundaries meshed where you can't pull apart, Were they too rigid? Where there wasn't enough love? There's a lot of things in family therapy that are powerful. So I thought about this when I working with the group and said, were you the identified patient? And again, explain to them what that was. Were you the person, and this was my younger son, who flew under the radar? Okay, were you the one that never got into trouble, kind of nobody really noticed that much because they were the good kid, okay? Were you the family clown? Were you the one, and you could be more than one, were you the one, and I was the family clown along with being identified patient, were you the one that always needed to make people laugh? Because in making people laugh, then there wasn't a chance of people crying, okay? Were you the one who was the pleaser? Did you always want to please and never walk around on eggshells because you didn't want to upset anybody? And, you know, were you the fixer in the family? Were you the one who wanted to fix everybody else and make sure that mom was okay? Were you parentified? What does that mean? At a young age, were you then turned into the parent? For those of you who are listening, it's frightening to me how much I see of this today, where children are parentified.
Yeah, I think people of the baby boom generation are probably one of the first generations that didn't grow up.
Right.
I think so the generation before the baby boomers, of course, they called them the silent generation. And they still had that kind of instruction. And their parents, the historians, call them the lost generation. And
a lot of alcoholism in that generation, too.
Oh, yes. And that was my grandparents' generation.
Yeah.
And as a kid growing up, alcohol was the drug of choice. And,
yeah.
You know, everybody drank. Some people drank more than others. And I think it was a generation, I guess, men knew how to hold their liquor.
Right. Yeah, that was a good expression, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so where, who were you?
Okay, that was also something that came out in the genogram, and it was easy for me to find my role. I was the one who flew under the radar.
Okay. And here's the reason. Somebody asked a powerful question in group one night. They said, why are you asking us to do this particular exercise? We understand the genogram, but why this? And actually, my initial answer wasn't as powerful as the one I gave the following week because Steve, who's my wonderful husband, who's ADD, also said, you know, you answered that, but you really didn't. And he was right, I didn't. So I went back and I thought about it, and here's the answer. So the reason I want people to look at what was the position in the family is because I want them to see who they were and where are they today. Are they still the identified patient in the family, in their married life? Are they the identified? Are they flying under the radar? Are they the family clown? What? Because I think it's important that we see, oh my God, you know what? I can guarantee there's a lot of people who say, I still am right there.
Yeah, if you don't self-individuate and you don't go through this process and grow up, you're going to remain. And I'm in my 50s now. I was the one who flew under the radar. My younger brother was the IP. And today, it's still the same. But, you know, the good thing is it's beginning to change.
Right.
Because my brother now is completely, as he likes to put it, he says, you know, for the first time since he was 13, he's got a clear head and he's not chemically altered.
Right.
He was smoking weed starting at age 13.
Right.
And I think he was just high for, you know, 40-plus years. And so I see him growing. He unfortunately does not live in Southern California because he's not able to be part of this Chad group. And hopefully we can get one going up in the Bay Area. And I know he would be somebody that could benefit from it greatly. And he's such a tremendous person that I know he would be able to help many other people as well as he's changing. But it is amazing how, for such a long time, I remained the one flying under the radar.
And I think that also what happens, it's not only, okay, so in my family, you know, I was the only one in my family that had three marriages. This is my third marriage. This is my last marriage. This is the first time in my life that I've been in a relationship as an adult and the first time I'm truly in love, because I understand what love is. Okay. Nobody in my family has been divorced except me. So I continued that pattern of being the IP. And the interesting thing is, as I look back on it, being that self-awareness coming out, I was very angry about it, but I was doing it. I didn't want them to treat me the way they treated me, but I was doing it. This past weekend, you know, when they came, it was very different because I'm different now. And I wonder how much they really get me or understand me now, because I don't interact with them the same way I used to. I love them and we get along great, but it's just very different for me. So in your family, it's still very much the same way.
It is, and I now have a greater understanding and sympathy for my younger brother, because he was the one that was just always kind of picked on. And it was like it was his problem. He was the one causing all the problems, and he was the one who gave my mother all her grades.
Did your dad, you don't talk much about your dad. Did your dad, was he involved in this too at the same time?
My father, because of his generation, they were much more, he's kind of a quiet man. He has a lot to say. He's very articulate. He's a very bright, entertaining, talented man. But it was really kind of overshadowed by my mom. And I think part of the family dynamic was that my mother, I mean, she's a remarkable woman in that her ability, her capacity to love others is tremendous. I feel I learned from her what it means, unconditional love, and she did so in her service. And her mother was that way as well. Also, unlike my mother, my grandmother couldn't really express herself. It's a whole other story of that time and culture that she grew up in. But for my mom, a very needy person, very demanding, and stubborn was one of her personality traits I think everybody would agree with. So on one hand, she's quite giving, she's quite sacrificial. On the other hand, there was no yielding. And I think my father, to make peace with her, he got tired of fighting her. And so he just kind of went quiet on her, and he just made peace and didn't engage her, because she really can't be argued with. That's something that she doesn't really want. I don't think she even recognizes it now. And it's kind of hard to get somebody who is so giving to recognize the fact that, you know, you're really kind of tough to live with. And sometimes, you know, you got to learn to bend, and you won't. And you're just a little tough on everybody. And
so, here's something, and I wonder, you just said something that triggered this for me, because you were talking about your grandmother, your mother's mother. And I remember that one night, we had the brother and sister that were a group who were really wonderful people. And the brother was very angry at the dad. Of course, I'm not using any names, so nobody would know who this is. But she was up there doing the family genogram. And one of the things that I said while she was doing the genogram was, wait, hold on for a minute. Your dad's mother was very depressed. And she said, yeah. I said, and you just found that out. She said, yeah, in doing this, I had to ask questions. I don't know if you remember this. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, there you go. Here's a big reason why possibly your father was the way he was. He had to deal with this depressed mother his whole life. And she had an aha moment, and I think her brother had one, too, at the same time. And I think, just to go back for a minute, it's just like your mom with your grandmother, you know, in doing these genograms, all of a sudden, for these people that we've been very angry at our whole life, for things, for criticism, for things that they said to hurt us, or that we perceived it that way, we now take a better look at their lives in this genogram and go, oh my God, now I understand why my mother was the way she was, or now I know why my father's father died when he was 5. My father didn't have a clue what it was like to be a child. Not a clue. Because he had to grow up when he was 5 years old. So that's why he was so incredibly strict. And I get that now. I understand it. So I was able to release that anger in being able to look at that. Did that help you with your mother?
Yes, and that's why I'm much more understanding of my mother and any hurts that I had felt that I never felt justified in feeling, because I was not allowed to to express that, hey, I'm upset.
You know, so you never felt heard?
Oh, definitely wasn't.
Right.
And unfortunately, I think for my parents, I was just a child that needed to express himself and needed to be heard.
So can I tell you a big difference I've seen in you? When I first met David, David would get on a soapbox about different topics, and he would start to talk about them and never be aware of the fact that people really didn't want to hear what he had to say. He kept going and going and going. That stems from never being heard growing up. That's where that behavior comes from. But now David is much different. He'll check in. He'll ask, can I talk about this for a minute? And he'll make it a minute. It's not 10 or 15 minutes. And you've also released a lot of anger towards certain subjects that you were very angry about.
Yeah, and if you were aware of the subjects, you would be angry too, but you still got to let it go. So for those of you who are ignorant, I guess ignorance is bliss.
Yes. But no, I want to compliment you because I know you've been doing a lot of work, and I think the most important thing in this emotional individuation process that you and I are trying to share with everybody out there is that there is growth. And there is change. And I would hope that we have about a little less than 20 minutes left that you and I could spend some time talking about your negative symptoms of ADD and how are they getting better.
Okay. Before I get into that, I want to address the fact that we were talking about family and something I said kind of at the beginning of our conversation today, and that is being more compassionate, kind, and patient with yourself and with others.
Mm-hmm.
And so when talking about family, I think there's a great need, no matter how you were raised, whether it was a lot of abuse or just a little bit of abuse, to be understanding, patient, and compassionate towards your parents and your other family members. Because
yes.
There has to be a need for forgiveness, both
yeah.
to forgive yourself for your the things you the mistakes you made and the things you've neglected to do.
Yes, and you want to know something, David, and I think this is really important. I had somebody in session yesterday who was talking about their aunt who developed breast cancer, okay, and that this was a very, very angry, angry person her entire life. And she was upset because she wanted to help her aunt and she didn't know how to help her. And what I've noticed over the years is that when we hold on to resentment, when we hold on to anger, when we absolutely refuse to see another person's perspective or side of something, that can really affect our health, can really affect the stress levels in our bodies and can cause us to develop some bad things. So when you talk about living your life with compassion and love and tenderness and kindness for other people. When I talk in group about communication, and it's always assertive and kind, I never leave off that word kind, because I really believe that if we role model to other people in our lives how to live that way, there'll be more happy people out there.
Absolutely. It's funny as you mention this, the thing I think of is, and you can call this manipulation, but I didn't really understand this till I was in my 20s, till I was already out of the house, had moved out of the area from where my parents lived and was out on my own and living my own life, was that when I go back and visit family during holidays or other times of the year, and in dealing with my mother, instead of butting heads with her, I kind of understood in my 20s that the way to work with her was not to fight her, but was to just be very loving. And
mm-hmm.
what she responds to is love.
Mm-hmm.
And yet she puts out a lot of, you know, just kind of pushing people around. And you know, I guess she just, as I said earlier, she felt she needed to be a drill sergeant to having four sons. And boys you handle a little differently than girls. And so she was able to kind of handle, I think boys can be handled a little bit more roughly. She has four granddaughters, and she's learned can't treat girls the way you treat boys. And so with her grandchildren, she treats the grandsons are okay, but the granddaughters, they've kind of taught her, and she is much more kinder because they'll just turn her like, you're going to treat me like that? I think I put up with that. It's really difference between cats and dogs.
No, it's true. Okay, so what do you think this individuation process, emotional individuation process, has helped you in terms of, how do you think it's helped you in terms of the negative symptoms of ADD?
First, you mentioned earlier about this incessant talking, and I think that was part of my anxiety. And now that I don't have as much anxiety, don't have these feelings going back to my past, I'm not being understood, so I got to keep on talking until you understand, I can just make my points and be done.
Great.
And I'm expressing it a lot more. I'm a very social person. It doesn't matter where I am. I've developed through the years just the ability to make small talk with anybody.
Right.
And to do it in a very kind of fun way, just play around with people and have an attitude that I really don't care. And that's something I had to work on because I think I was always affected by what people thought of me.
Okay.
And so as a mechanism to kind of protect myself from that, I just learned how to approach people and joke with people. But the problem is, once I engage people in conversation, then I get on my soapbox.
Right.
And when I wasn't aware, I think people were just looking for the exits.
You didn't get those cues.
Oh, no. I think even when I was beginning, I just ignored them. And so I was just irritating to other people. Just this annoying stranger engaging somebody in the parking lot at the grocery store, post office, or
they'll never go back
place.
To that grocery store.
Well,
again.
If they do, they're going to get out of the car. They're looking both ways and see if this guy's showing up.
This
and if
crazy
so, I'm
guy.
Going around the back.
I
can make it fun, but that's still not the way to do it. Now,
so what about procrastination?
Well, I want to finish what I'm doing now. Now I can go with people, and I can make my little point, and then I'm done and I move on.
Okay.
So instead of waiting for their body language to tell me, hey, I'm done here, I'll disengage beforehand.
Right.
And so it's just this quick little interaction and just say something kind of fun. And nothing negative. If it's an observation that we find in common, because there's certain things you observe that aren't good. If you're in a grocery store and there's like 20 people in line, there's only one register open.
Right.
And of course, that people are kind of like, what's this all about? But you don't need to make a big deal of it. You make your point, and we're all kind of commiserating together, and we're just hoping that they're going to get another checker to get in line. Now, you asked me about procrastination. I'm still working on that.
Okay.
I think it has to do with feelings. And the other thing that I'm realizing is that when I'm engaged in thoughts, doing stuff.
That's what it is.
And so all I'm doing now is that, if you're sitting in your chair at your desk or I don't work from the couch, but, probably the worst place if you need to work is to sit on the couch.
Right.
Because then you engage in your thoughts. Then you have to stand up, get up off
That's
the couch.
That's what I do.
And
what I said.
And just start getting in action.
You have to break the process. See, first of all, if you engage in the thoughts of procrastination, then you're going to procrastinate. If you just notice them instead of engaging in them, and then you kind of like, okay, I'm going to stand up for just a second. I'm going to break this process, and then I'm going to sit down, and I'm going to get done what I decided last night I was going to get done this morning.
I'm still working on disengaging because I find I still engage the thoughts.
Okay.
And when you said you have to recognize the thoughts,
Just notice
them. Notice the thought.
Right.
When I can just notice the thought, it doesn't cling to me. It doesn't grab hold of me. I can just see it mentally, just like a puff of smoke. Just the wind carries it away, and it's gone. And now my mind is clear. And I can get to work.
Right. So along with individuation process, we work on mindfulness a lot, right? How are you doing with focusing, with the mindfulness, staying in the moment? Or can you stay focused for a longer period of time, not engaging, again, in the thoughts, just noticing the thoughts?
Yeah, I am. And I think it's just coming down to the fact that I'm disciplining myself to do this.
Okay.
And what's wonderful is that I'm disciplining myself, and it's not as stressful, it's not as arduous, it's not what I call, I'm not white-knuckling it. And I look back in my youth and what it enabled me to achieve and to, you know, go on to college and graduate from college was the fact that I was very disciplined in many areas, did a lot of athletics, and I was kept very busy with a lot of activities, and I didn't really have much time to think about anything. I had to move from one activity to the next, and that's really no way to live, but that was my way of coping. But still, I was white-knuckling all the way through. And I, as I've been going through this process, I said, you know, I recognize the need to, I call it, to rediscipline myself, to get back into that discipline that I had in my youth.
Right.
And I think that's good at any age. But then to do it in a way that is not carefree, it's, well, it was stress-free, certainly. I'm trying to think of what the right word would be. But to do it more effortlessly.
Okay.
And that sounds kind of a contradiction, to be disciplined and effortlessly. But
no, I know what you mean. I understand what you mean. I mean, you could be disciplined to do something, but then the whole idea of doing something can be more effortless
because you're, in
you're
the,
more focused.
Well, we call it today being in the flow.
In the flow. Okay. Or being sitting in the seat of consciousness, in awareness.
But that's a new concept for me. That's
right.
That was not part of my growing up or
no,
anything.
Mine either.
But it's a wonderful way. I think it's I like that concept.
It's a wonderful concept. I mean, if you think about you just being able to sit in that seat of consciousness and just notice the world as it goes by and not having to engage in all the stuff that
and
comes up.
And you enjoy it.
And you enjoy it.
Because there's a lot of things in life that are enjoyable. I mean, here today, the past couple of days in Southern California, it's like we're finally having summer.
It's, right. It's beautiful.
It's a beautiful, wonderful day,
right.
And it's perfect. And
right.
This is...
So, okay, what about emotional regulation? There's another negative symptom, and we talked about this before when I told you how those feelings would come up for me, like tidal waves, and in this process I learned how to deal with that.
Okay, I can give you some... I won't belabor the examples, but just give the high notes on it. I know dealing with my wife, because in a marriage relationship, it can be very emotional, even the best of situations for anybody, ADD or non-ADD.
Right.
But I'm finding that my wife is bringing up things in the past that would really bother me. I'm not reacting. I'm not getting so emotional. Because, you know, she's just kind of laying out the facts. Here's the situation here.
Right.
And so she's not trying to press my buttons. I mean, there are relationships we have with people. There's other people in marriages where their spouses will deliberately press their buttons. But my wife doesn't do that. And if she does, I can recognize it. I call her out on it. But she really does it so rarely that it's really not an issue. And so I think, like, and, of course, all the women in the audience are going to agree with this, that, of course, anything the women bring up deals with finances and how the household is run and what needs to get done. You know, everything the women brings up these are legitimate issues.
Right.
And as men, of course, we may beg to differ. But in the past where I would get upset, now I'm able to deal with what she's bringing up and to deal with it and say, okay, what are we going to do about this?
Great.
And so I'm feeling better.
There's that adult coming
well,
out.
That's just it. I'm acting like an adult, which she really does. The other party, the partner in marriage, they really deserve that.
Right. No, they do. And so the other thing I'm sitting here thinking about, and then we're going to have to end soon, is I'm sad because we have more to talk about, but David's going to be back, and he's going to come back in probably another couple of months just to see where he's at, and I'm excited about that.
Okay, if you want me, I'll be back.
No, absolutely, David.
Putting pressure on me. I got to continue to grow here.
No, this is wonderful, but to get to the marriage for a minute, one of the reasons that I think that Steve and I are able to do as well as we do, because we've been living together for 3 years already, is we don't have any fear. There's no fear in this relationship. You know, I made a pledge when I got into this relationship that I wasn't going to let my last relationship, when I was cheated on by my husband, define who I was for the rest of my life. So therefore, I don't have to check Steve's Facebook or his phone or worry about what he's doing. And he's the same way with I. We're both adults in this relationship. We have tons of fun. Do we have moments where we're both ADD? Absolutely. But for the most part, we do pretty well. So one of the things I want to share with the audience is that what I'm planning on for next week is one of the other members of our group has gone to the next step and has started to write the letter to the little child inside of her. And I'm not going to share with you what's happened so far, but it's really powerful. So I'm going to ask her next week to come on the program and to really talk about what's happening for her, because that's really the last step, is writing that letter to that little kid that we all have that wants to come up all the time and is angry and is still feeling sad or just wants to get us crazy. And that's where we need to really give that little child a lot of love and compassion, and which is exactly what I did. And I wrote the letter, and I'll share that next week. So I would hope all of you would join us again next week as we continue this process of individuation. And David is going to be back with us in a couple of months so we can check in on his progress. He has certainly made a tremendous amount of progress, and I know this firsthand because I work with him once a week privately, and he's at the group every Wednesday night. So I want to thank everybody for listening today. I'm going to try at the end to press a button and see if my son's ending music comes up, because I'm excited about that. But before that, I just want to remind everybody that on Wednesday nights, I run a group, an adult support group, powerful support group. David can absolutely attest to that.
Absolutely. No, it's been coming now about a year and 4 months, and I can truly say that since coming to the group, my life is radically changed and is continuing to change. And,
which is so great.
And I can say, for those of you that have kind of lost hope, that's where I was before I showed up. And just within a short time, I recognized, I said, look, I can do this. There, I can get the tools I need. I can get the help. There are people that are in the same boat that I am. I'm not alone in this. I can get help. And we can help one another,
right?
And together we can all grow and change.
Right, and the other piece of that whole thing is that when people come to me privately or come to the group, I tell everybody, I can't fix you. I can give you the tools to fix yourself. And if you're willing to do the work, and David was very willing to do the work, then things will change for you and things will get better, and you will be screaming to everybody you know that ADD is a gift from God, because it is. It's an incredible gift, and that's what makes me so excited. So, again, it's held at the Center for Learning Unlimited, 2785 Pacific Coast Highway in Torrance, California. Also, if any of you are interested in a coaching session with me, you can contact me through my website, missadd.com. We've been working on the website, and I think there's a place now where you can go and kind of sign up if you'd like an appointment. Or I also Skype for those of you who are not in California or are not in the Los Angeles area and want a session with me. I also Skype online. Also, my Facebook page, if all of you would be kind enough to go and like it. I do have some really good information on that page. It's called Miss ADD. And very soon my book is coming out, which I'm really excited about, The Gift of ADD. So I want to thank everybody again for listening. I will be back again next week at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And remember, please, to stay in the moment. Have a good night. Take care.